Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When we talk about the suffragette movement, a few key names and places stand out in history. The Seneca Fall Convention, Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Stanton, and of course Susan B. Anthony. But in her new book about the movement's Massachusetts connections, historian Barbara Berenson argues that our understanding of history leaves out important voices and events right here in the Bay State. Berenson writes that the women's rights movement actually began here, that the first National Women's Rights Convention was held in Worcester, and that in remembering Stanton and Anthony, we forget locals Lucy Stone and the Grimke sisters. Barbara Berenson's new book is Massachusetts in the Women's Suffrage Movement, Revolutionary Reformers, and she joins me now in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so you make the argument that really when we think about the suffragette movement, we should be thinking back to roughly 1837. Is that right?
Correct. I mean, one of the things that historians always have to decide is when a movement starts. And the convention in recent years or for many decades has been Seneca Falls in 1848. But of course, that begs the question, why Seneca Falls? What happened that led to Seneca Falls? And the argument I make in my book is that really the movement began in Massachusetts in the summer of 1837.
With the Grimke sisters.
Correct.
Who were they?
Angelina and Sarah Grimke were two extraordinary women from Charleston, South Carolina. They were the white daughters of a wealthy slave-owning family. And they left Charleston, went to Philadelphia, and became involved in the abolitionist movement, which at that point was a very new movement. 1831 was the beginning of the newspaper The Liberator, published in Boston. And Angelina and Sarah became such passionate abolitionists that they were trained to be anti-slavery agents to go out and speak against slavery and were sent on a tour throughout Massachusetts in the summer of 1837.
Okay, so but they were advocating for abolition, though. How did that then lead them to pushing for suffrage?
Well, that is the perfect question. What happened was it was really not accepted in that era that women would speak out on political issues at all, and certainly, above all, not accepted that women would speak to audiences of men and women about political issues. But that's precisely what Angelina and Sarah Grimke did. They spoke to audiences of men and women throughout Massachusetts. And leaders in Massachusetts, including particularly Congregational church leaders, tried to shut them down and said that what they were doing was unacceptable and, in fact, would bring degeneracy and ruin upon society.
Oh, sure.
They resisted, they refuted, and they fought back.
I mean, I love how you wrote that they were criticizing. This is such wonderful 19th century language, from departing from a woman's sphere.
Correct.
Yeah. But I mean, you quote Angelina Grimke as writing, "I contend that woman has just as much right to sit in solemn council in conventions, conferences, associations, and general assemblies as man, just as much right to sit in the presidential chair of the United States."
Correct. So in 1837, when they were told to sit down and shut up, they did not. They continued speaking, and they wrote a powerful series of letters defending a woman's rights to speak out on political issues, including making statements such as the one you just read. And that, I argue in my book, is really the start of the women's rights movement, when women began to speak out, arguing for their right to have a voice in political issues.
Yeah. So can you read a little bit to us from the introduction of the book? Because again, we have the privilege of looking back at what was happening in 1837, 1848, 1850, from the lens of 2018. I think we just need to be reminded how radical it really was, advocating for suffrage. And I'd love if you could just read a little bit from the book.
Certainly. Women advocating for the right to vote faced difficulties that are almost unimaginable from our contemporary perspective. They had to challenge centuries of domestic tradition, church teachings, and legal doctrines that confined women to the domestic sphere and excluded them from civic participation. They lacked tools with which to seize or win power. Suffragists had to open women's eyes to their own lack of rights. They then had to persuade men, who possessed all the power, to share it. No wonder success required a campaign waged by three generations of courageous, visionary, and persistent women activists. Their victory was never inevitable.
That's Barbara Berenson reading from her book, Massachusetts in the Woman Suffrage Movement, Revolutionary Reformers. I want to ask you, Barbara, I'm still taken by the fact that the Grimke sisters, for example, felt a sense of their own political empowerment because of the abolitionist movement. I mean, that seems to be kind of central to the emergence of pro-suffrage activity in Massachusetts because the state was such a hotbed of abolition. Could you see the two happening independently of each other, or are they inextricably intertwined?
That's a great question. I think personally that they are inextricably intertwined. The women's rights movement emerged directly from within the abolitionist movement. And it was the leaders of the abolitionist movement, such as William Lloyd Garrison, who welcomed women to be full participants in the movement, which was an incredibly radical position.
Fully enfranchised women? Well, did he welcome that? Or
yes, Garrison did. I mean, Garrison was at the very radical end of the abolitionists, but yes, he did.
Okay. So tell us, and I want to hear about some of the more key women here. Lucy Stone, we haven't talked about her. Who was she?
Lucy Stone is certainly one of the heroes of my book. Lucy Stone graduated from Oberlin College in 1847 and immediately began lecturing both in support of women's rights and against slavery. And she became perhaps the most popular lecturer during the 1840s and 1850s, both for women's rights and against slavery. She also was a key organizer of the first National Women's Rights Convention, which was held, as you mentioned earlier, right here in Worcester in 1850.
Okay, so tell us more about that, because I think, you know, as we mentioned at the top here, many people may have a passing knowledge of Seneca Falls at least, but I don't think the Worcester Convention of 1850 really comes up in folks' mind. What happened there?
Well, so the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848 was certainly a very important convention. It was a local convention. It was women in upstate New York, and there were a couple of other local conventions also in the late 1840s. Lucy Stone and her allies had this brilliant idea that they should organize a national convention. And about 1,000 women from 11 different states congregated in Worcester in 1850 to have a whole convention dedicated to women's rights. And not only did they have this convention, but then they set up a system of annual conventions. So there were annual conventions virtually every year during the 1850s. They also established committees to carry out all sorts of organizing and advocacy between conventions. It really was the start of the organized movement.
I see. So it provided the momentum for that. Okay.
Correct.
So 1850s, though, I mean, we're headed straight towards the Civil War. That obviously disrupted these efforts dramatically.
Correct. The Civil War was a great interrupter. What happened during the Civil War was Lucy Stone, along with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, turned their attention to supporting the war effort, to supporting the effort to eradicate slavery from the nation. And then they resumed with the women's rights movement really right after the Civil War ended in 1865.
But that produced a schism between these women.
That produced an enormous schism, putting Lucy Stone on the one side and Anthony and Stanton on the other side. And the schism was over the 15th Amendment, which, of course, granted the right to vote to black men but left women out. Those three women had hoped that instead Congress would pass an amendment that would provide universal franchise and would enfranchise both black men and black and white women.
So Stone nevertheless supported the 15th Amendment, right?
Correct. Stone said it was terrible that women were left out, but it's wonderful that somebody is getting the vote, and therefore I support the 15th Amendment and will continue to dedicate my efforts now to enfranchising women.
Okay. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton is Susan B. Anthony did not support it.
Correct.
This is a side of them that I haven't heard about all that much. I mean, you write about that Stone found Anthony's and Stanton's racist commentary during the debate over the amendment unpardonable.
It's a part of Anthony and Stanton's history that certainly scholars know well, but is almost absent from popular culture, from popular knowledge of them. But yes, they opposed the 15th Amendment in horrifyingly racist terms.
Sorry, I mean, it takes my breath away a little bit because we think of them as these champions of women's rights, and I guess in our minds it just bleeds into civil rights as a whole.
Right. And of course, I mean, later on, there was a reconciliation between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass, for example. I mean, they were great heroines of American history in many ways. But there was this, you know, horrible, unpardonable racism after the Civil War over the 15th Amendment. And as I said, scholars certainly are well aware of it. But for various reasons, and this gets into the politics of writing history, that story has not been well known.
Interesting. Okay. Now, what about African American women in this movement? Because obviously they suffered the double burden of both racism and slavery and, being women, disenfranchised women as well.
Correct. They certainly did suffer the double burden. When the schism occurred after the Civil War, the Lucy Stone Wing, which was based here in Boston, welcomed black women into the movement. The Anthony Stanton Wing, which was based in New York, did not. Later in 1890, when the two groups were reconciled, which is also 3 years before Lucy Stone dies, the joint movement, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, was, for a variety of reasons we can discuss, primarily, although not entirely, a white movement.
Hmm. Okay. Can you tell us briefly about one or two of those reasons? Because I do want to get into how Massachusetts shouldn't actually pat itself on the back too much.
Absolutely. So. The brief answer is that the women's suffrage movement, like any movement, does not exist independently from all the social currents swirling around society around it. And in 1890, when the joint movement was formed, it was the height of Jim Crow. These women knew that they were going to have to ultimately get Southern support for what became the 19th Amendment. Many of them, of course, were somewhat racist or largely racist anyway. And they made a compromise with the devil, so to speak, to not worry about whether or not black women would be enfranchised. I mean, the amendment would enfranchise all women, but they tacitly agreed they would turn a blind eye to the Southern attempts to restrict voting by black women as well as by black men.
Okay. And one last thing, just very briefly. Now, I mean, we've been talking about Massachusetts women as key to the suffragette movement, but you do write that Massachusetts as a state actually lagged behind other states significantly in giving suffrage to women. We just got under a minute to go here.
Okay. That's correct. I mean, Massachusetts had a faction of conservative blue bloods as well as others who were very opposed to changing the status quo, very opposed to enfranchising women. And so ironically, the home of Lucy Stone and this abolitionist movement became really a leading center of the movement against suffrage.
Wow. And so Massachusetts women only got the right to vote after the adoption of the 19th Amendment.
Correct. Not until 1920.
Wow. Okay. Well, Barbara Barron is author of the new book, Massachusetts in the Woman Suffrage Movement, Revolutionary Reformers. She's a senior attorney at the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, and she'll be speaking at the Worcester Historical Museum on May 10th. We've got more information about that at radioboston.org. Barbara, it is always such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.